He looked back over his shoulder and said, "You follow right behind Mummy, Eddie. I'll need you." The light faded to the faintest gray, held that way briefly, and then it was gone and they were out of the blue and into the black. Bill shuffled forward through the stink, feeling that he was almost cutting through it physically, one hand held out before him, part of him expecting that at any moment it would encounter rough hair, and green lamp-like eyes would open in the darkness. The end would come in one hot flare of pain as it walloped his head off his shoulders. The dark was stuffed with sounds, all of them magnified and echoing. He could hear his friend shuffling along behind him, sometimes muttering something. There were gurglings and strange clanking groans. Once a flood of sickeningly warm water washed past and between his legs, wetting him to the thighs and rocking him back on his heels. He felt Eddie clutch frantically at the back of his shirt, and then the small flood slackened. From the end of the line, Richie bellowed with sorry good humor, "I think we've just been pissed on by the Jolly Green Giant, Bill." Bill could hear water or sewage running in controlled bursts through the network of smaller pipes, which now must be over their heads. He remembered the conversation about Derry's sewers with his father and thought he knew what this pipe must be. It was to handle the overflow that only occurred during heavy rains and during the flood season. The stuff up there would be leaving Derry to be dumped in Toralt Stream and the Penobscot River. The city didn't like to pump its shit into the Kanduskeag because it made the canal stink. But all the so-called gray water went into the Kanduskeag, and if there was too much for the regular sewer pipes to handle, there would be a dump-off. Like the one that had just happened. If there had been one, there could be another. He glanced up uneasily, not able to see anything, but knowing that there must be grates in the top arch of the pipe, possibly in the sides as well, and that any moment there might be... He wasn't aware he'd reached the end of the pipe until he fell out of it and staggered forward, pinwheeling his arms in a helpless effort to keep his balance. He fell on his belly into a semi-solid mass about 2 feet below the mouth of the pipe he'd just tumbled out of. Something ran squeaking over his hand. He screamed and sat up, clutching his tingling hand to his chest, aware that a rat had just run over it. He had felt the loathsome, plaited drag of the thing's hairless tail. He tried to stand up and wrapped his head on the new pipe's low ceiling. It was a hard hit, and Bill was driven back to his knees with large red flowers exploding in the darkness before his eyes. "Be careful," he heard himself shouting. His words echoed flatly. "It drops off here. Eddie, where are you? "Here." One of Eddie's waving hands brushed Bill's nose. "Help me out, Bill. I can't see. It's..." There was a huge watery kerwash. Beverly, Mike, and Richie all screamed in unison. In the daylight, the almost perfect harmony the three of them made would have been funny. Down here in the dark, in the sewers, it was terrifying. Suddenly, all of them were tumbling out. Bill clutched Eddie in a bear hug, trying to save his arm. "Oh, Christ, I thought I was going to drown," Richie moaned. "We got doused. Oh, boy, a shit shower. Oh, great. They ought to have a class trip down here sometime, Bill. We could get Mr. Carson to lead it." "And Miss Jimison could give us a health lecture afterward," Ben said in a trembling voice, and they all laughed shrilly. As the laughter was tapering off, Stan suddenly burst into miserable tears. "Don't, man," Richie said, putting a fumbling arm around Stan's sticky shoulders. "You'll get us all crying, man." "I'm all right," Stan said loudly, still crying. "I can stand to be scared, but I hate being dirty like this. I hate not knowing where I am." "Do you think any of the matches are still any good?" Bill asked Richie. "I gave mine to Beth." Bill felt a hand touch his in the darkness and press a folder of matches into it. They felt dry. "I kept them in my armpit," she said. "They might work. You can try them anyway." Bill tore a match out of the folder and struck it. It popped a light and he held it up. His friends were huddled together, wincing at the brief bright flare of light. They were splashed and daubed with ordure, and they all looked very young and very afraid. Behind them, he could see the sewer pipe they had come out of. The pipe they were in now was smaller still. It ran straight in both directions, its floor caked with layers of filthy sediment, and... He drew in a quick hiss and shook the match out as it burned his fingers. He listened and heard the sounds of fast-running water, dripping water, the occasional gushing roar as the overflow valves worked, sending more sewage into the Kanduskeag, which was now God only knew how far behind them. He didn't hear Henry and the others. Yet. He said quietly,
"There's a dead body on my river right, about 10 feet away from us. I think it might be
Patrick?" Beverly asked, her voice trembling on the edge of hysteria.
"Is it Patrick Hockstetter?"
Yes.
"Do you want me to light another match?"
Eddie said, "You got to, Bill. If I don't see how the pipe runs, I won't know which way to go."
Bill lit the match. In its glow, they all saw the green, swelled thing that had been Patrick Hockstetter. The corpse grinned at them in the dark with horrid chumminess, but with only half a face. Sewer rats had taken the rest. Patrick's summer school books were scattered around him, bloated to the size of dictionaries in the damp.
"Christ,"
Mike said hoarsely, his eyes wide.
"I hear them again," Beverly said. "Henry and the others."
The acoustics must have carried her voice to them as well. Henry bellowed down the sewer pipe, and for a moment it was as if he was standing right there.
"We'll get you."
"You come on right ahead,"
Richie shouted. His eyes were bright, dancing, febrile.
"Keep coming, Banana Heels. This is just like the YMCA swimming pool down here. Keep..."
Then a shriek of such mad fear and pain came through the pipe that the guttering match fell from Bill's finger and went out. Eddie's arm had curled around him and Bill hugged Eddie back, feeling his body trembling like a wire as Stan Uris packed close to him on the other side. That shriek rose and rose, and then there was an obscene, thick, flapping noise, and the shriek was cut off.
"Something got one of them,"
Mike choked, horrified in the darkness.
"Something, some monster. Bill, we got to get out of here, please."
Bill could hear whoever was left. One or two, with the acoustics it was impossible to tell, stumbling and scrabbling through the sewer pipe toward them.
"Well, which way, Eddie?"
he asked urgently. Do you know?
"Toward the canal?"
Eddie asked, shaking in Bill's arms.
"Yes." "To the right, past Patrick."
"Or over him."
Eddie's voice suddenly hardened.
"I don't care that much. He was one of the ones that broke my arm, spit in my face, too."
"Let's go," Bill said, looking back at the sewer pipe they had just quitted.
"Single the line. Keep a touch on each other, like before."
He groped forward, dragging his right shoulder along the slimy porcelain surface of the pipe, gritting his teeth, not wanting to step on Patrick or into him. So they crawled farther into the darkness while waters rushed around them and while, outside, the storm walked and talked and brought an early darkness to Derry. A darkness that screamed with wind and stuttered with electric fire and racketed with falling trees that sounded like the death cries of huge prehistoric creatures. 3. It. May, 1985.
Now they were coming again. And while everything had gone much as it had foreseen, something it had not foreseen had returned. That maddening, galling fear, that sense of another.
It hated the fear, would have turned on it and eaten it if it could have. But the fear danced mockingly out of reach, and it could only kill the fear by killing them. Surely there was no need for such fear. They were older now, and their number had been reduced from 7 to 5. 5 was a number of power, but it did not have the mystical, talismanic quality of 7. It was true that its dog's body hadn't been able to kill the librarian, but the librarian would die in the hospital. Later, just before dawn touched the sky, it would send a male nurse with a bad pill habit to finish the librarian once and for all. The writer's woman was now with it. Alive, yet not alive. Her mind had been utterly destroyed by her first sight of it as it really was, with all of its little masks and glamours thrown aside. And all of the glamours were only mirrors, of course, throwing back at the terrified viewer the worst thing in his or her own mind. Heliographing images as a mirror might bounce a reflection of the sun into a wide, unsuspecting eye and stun it to blindness. Now the mind of the writer's wife was with it, in it, beyond the end of the macroverse, in the darkness beyond the turtle, in the outlands beyond all lands.
She was in its eye. She was in its mind. She was in the deadlights. Oh, but the glamours were amusing. Hanlon, for instance. He would not remember, not consciously, but his mother could have told him where the bird he had seen at the ironworks came from. When he was a baby, only 6 months old, his mother had left him sleeping in his cradle in the side yard while she went around back to hang sheets and diapers on the line. His screams had brought her on the run. A large crow had lighted on the edge of the carriage and was pecking at baby Mikey like an evil creature in a nursery tale. He had been screaming in pain and terror, unable to drive away the crow, which had sensed weak prey. She had struck the bird with her fist and driven it off, seeing that it had brought blood in two or three places on baby Mikey's arms, and taken him to Dr. Stillwagon for a tetanus shot. A part of Mike had remembered that always. Tiny baby, giant bird. And when it came to Mike, Mike had seen the giant bird again. But when the dog's body husband of the girl from before brought the writer's woman, it had put on no face. It did not dress when it was at home. The dog's body husband had looked once and had dropped dead of shock, his face gray, his eyes filling with the blood that had squirted out of his brain in a dozen places. The writer's woman had put out one powerful, horrified thought. Oh, dear Jesus, it is female. And then all thoughts ceased. She swam in the deadlights. It came down from its place and took care of her physical remains, prepared them for later feeding. Now Audra Denbro hung high up in the middle of things, crisscrossed in silk, her head lolling against the socket of her shoulder, her eyes wide and glazed, her toes pointing down. But there was still power in them, diminished but still there. They had come here as children, and somehow, against all the odds, against all that was supposed to be, all that could be, they had hurt it badly, had almost killed it, had forced it to flee deep into the earth, where it huddled, hurt and hating and trembling in a spreading pool of its own strange blood. So another new thing, if you please. For the first time in its never-ending history, it needed to make a plan. For the first time, it found itself afraid simply to take what it wanted from Derry, its private game preserve. It had always fed well on children. Many adults could be used without knowing they had been used, and it had even fed on a few of the older ones over the years. Adults had their own terrors, and their glands could be tapped, opened so that all the chemicals of fear flooded the body and salted the meat. But their fears were mostly too complex. The fears of children were simpler and usually more powerful. The fears of children could often be summoned up in a single face, and if bait were needed, why, what child did not love a clown? It understood vaguely that these children had somehow turned its own tools against it, that by coincidence, surely not on purpose, surely not guided by the hand of any other, by the bonding of seven extraordinarily imaginative minds, it had been brought into a zone of great danger. Any one of these seven alone would have been its meat and drink, and if they had not happened to come together, it surely would have picked them off one by one, drawn by the quality of their minds, just as a lion might be drawn to one particular waterhole by the scent of zebra. But together they had discovered an alarming secret that even it had not been aware of. That belief has a second edge. If there are 10,000 medieval peasants who create vampires by believing them real, there may be one, probably a child, who will imagine the stake necessary to kill it. But a stake is only stupid wood. The mind is the mallet which drives it home. Yet in the end, it had escaped, had gone deep, and the exhausted, terrified children had elected not to follow it when it was at its most vulnerable. They had elected to believe it dead or dying, and had retreated. It was aware of their oath, and had known they would come back just as a lion knows the zebra will eventually return to the waterhole. It had begun to plan, even as it began to drowse. When it woke, it would be healed, renewed, but their childhoods would be burned away like seven fatty candles. The former power of their imaginations would be muted and weak. They would no longer imagine that there were piranha in the Kanduskeag, or that if you stepped on a crack you might really break your mother's back, or that if you killed a ladybug which lit on your shirt, your house would catch fire that night. Instead, they would believe in insurance. Instead, they would believe in wine with dinner, something nice but not too pretentious, like a Pouilly Fouisse 83. And let that breathe, waiter, would you? Instead, they would believe that Rolaids consume 47 times their own weight in excess stomach acid. Instead, they would believe in public television, Gary Hart, running to prevent heart attacks, giving up red meat to prevent colon cancer. They would believe in Dr. Ruth when it came to getting well fucked and Jerry Falwell when it came to getting well saved. As each year passed, their dreams would grow smaller. And when it woke, it would call them back. Yes, back. Because fear was fertile. Its child was rage, and rage cried for revenge. It would call them, and then kill them. Only now that they were coming, the fear had returned. They had grown up, and their imaginations had weakened, but not as much as it had believed. It had felt an ominous, upsetting growth in their power when they joined together, and it had wondered for the first time if it had perhaps made a mistake. But why be gloomy? The die was cast, and not all the omens were bad. The writer was half mad for his wife, and that was good. The writer was the strongest, the one who had somehow trained his mind for this confrontation over all the years. And when the writer was dead with his guts falling out of his body, when their precious Big Bill was dead, the others would be its quickly. It would feed well, and then perhaps it would go deep again and doze for a while. 4. In the tunnels, 4:30 a.m.
Bill!
Richie shouted into the echoing pipe. He was moving as fast as he could, but that wasn't very fast. He remembered that as kids they had walked bent over in this pipe, which led away from the pumping station in the Barrens. He was crawling now, and the pipe seemed impossibly tight. His glasses kept wanting to slide off the end of his nose, and he kept pushing them up again. He could hear Bev and Ben behind him.
Bill,
he bawled again.
Eddie.
I'm here, Eddie's voice floated back.
Where's Bill?
Richie shouted.
Up ahead, Eddie called.
He was very close now, and Richie sensed rather than saw him just ahead.
He wouldn't wait.
Richie's head butted Eddie's leg. A moment later, Bev's head butted Richie's ass.
Bill,
Richie screamed at the top of his voice. The pipe channeled his shout and sent it back at him, hurting his own ears.
Bill, wait for us. We have to go together. Don't you know that?
Faintly echoing, Bill.
Audra! Audra! Where are you?
God damn you, Big Bill,
Richie cried softly. His glasses fell off. He cursed, groped for them, and set them, dripping, back on his nose. He pulled in breath and shouted again.
You'll get lost without Eddie, you fucking asshole. Wait up. Wait up for us. You hear me, Bill? Wait up for us, damn it.
There was an agonizing moment of silence. It seemed that no one breathed. All Richie could hear was distant dripping water. The drain was dry this time, except for the occasional stagnant puddle.
Bill!
He ran a trembling hand through his hair and fought the tears.
Come on! Please, man! Wait up! Please!
And fainter still, Bill's voice came back.
I'm waiting.
Thank God for small favors, Richie muttered. He slapped Eddie's can. Go.
I don't know how long I can with just one arm, Eddie said apologetically.
Go anyway, Richie said,
and Eddie began crawling again. Bill, looking haggard and almost used up, was waiting for them in the sewer shaft where the three pipes were lined up like lenses on a dead traffic light. There was room enough here for them to stand up.
Over there,
Bill said.
Chris. And Belch.
They looked. Beverly moaned, and Ben put an arm around her. The skeleton of Belch Huggins, clad in moldering rags, seemed more or less intact. What remained of Victor was headless. Bill looked across the shaftway and saw a grinning skull.
There it was.
The rest of him.
Should have left it alone, guys,
Bill thought and shivered. This section of the sewer system had fallen into disuse. Richie thought the reason why was pretty clear. The waste treatment plant had taken over. Sometime during the years when they were all busy learning to shave, to drive, to smoke, to fuck around a little, all that good shit, the Environmental Protection Agency had come into being, and the EPA had decided dumping raw sewage, and even gray water, into rivers and streams was a no-no. So this part of the sewer system had simply moldered, and the bodies of Victor Chris and Belch Huggins had moldered along with it. Like Peter Pan's Wild Boys, Victor and Belch had never grown up. Here were the skeletons of two boys and the shredded remains of T-shirts and jeans that had rotted away to rags. Moss had grown over the warped xylophone of Victor's rib cage and over the eagle on the buckle of his garrison belt.
"Monster got him," Ben said softly. "Do you remember? We heard it happen. Audra's dead."
Bill's voice was mechanical.
"I know it."
"You don't know any such thing," Beverly said with such fury that Bill stirred and looked at her. "All you know for sure is that a lot of other people have died, most of them children."
She walked across to him and stood before him with her hands on her hips. Her face and hands were streaked with grime, her hair matted with dirt. Richie thought she looked absolutely magnificent.
"And you know what did it?"
"I never should have told her where I was going," Bill said.
"Why did I do that? Why did I?"
Her hands pistoned out and seized him by the shirt. Amazed, Richie watched as she shook him.
"No more. You know what we came for? We swore, and we're going to do it.
Do you understand me, Bill? If she's dead, she's dead. But it's not. Now we need you. Do you get it? We need you."
She was crying now.
"So you stand up for us. You stand up for us like before, or none of us are going to get out of here."
He looked at her for a long time without speaking, and Richie found himself thinking, "Come on, Big Bill. Come on, come on." Bill looked around at the rest of them and nodded.
Eddie? "I'm here, Bill.
Do you still remember which pipe? Eddie pointed past Victor and said,
"That's the one.
Looks pretty small, doesn't it?"
Bill nodded again. "Can you do it with your arm broken?"
"I can for you, Bill."
Bill smiled, the weariest, most terrible smile Richie had ever seen.
"Take us there, Eddie. Let's get it done."
5. In the tunnels. 4:55 a.m. As he crawled, Bill reminded himself of the drop-off at the end of this pipe, but it still surprised him. At one moment, his hands were shuffling along the crusted surface of the old pipe. At the next, they were skating on air. He pitched forward and rolled instinctively, landing on his shoulder with a painful crunch.
"Be careful," he heard himself shouting. "Here's the hop-off.
Eddie?
Here."
One of Eddie's waving hands brushed across Bill's forehead.
"Can you help me out?"
He got his arms around Eddie and lifted him out, trying to be careful of the bad arm. Ben came next, then Bev, then Richie.
"You got any mama matches, Richie?"
"I do,"
Beverly said. Bill felt a hand touch his in the darkness and press a folder of matches into it.
"There's only 8 or 10, but Ben's got more, from the room."
Bill said, "Did you keep them in your armpit, Bev?"
"Not this time," she said,
and put her arms around him in the dark. He hugged her tight, eyes closed, trying to take the comfort she wanted so badly to give. He released her gently and struck a match. The power of memory was great. They all looked at once to their right. What remained of Patrick Hockstetter's body was still there, amid a few lumpy, overgrown things that might have been books. The only real recognizable thing was a jutting semicircle of teeth, 2 or 3 of them with fillings.
And something nearby.
A gleaming circle barely seen in the match's guttering light. Bill shook the match out and lit another. He picked it up.
"Audra's wedding ring," he said.
His voice was hollow, expressionless. The match went out in his fingers. In the darkness, he put the ring on.
"Bill," Richie said hesitantly, "do you have any idea?"
6. In the tunnels. 2:20 p.m. How long they had been wandering through the tunnels under Derry since they had left the place where Patrick Hockstetter's body was? But Bill was sure he could never find his way back. He kept thinking about what his father had said.
You could wander for weeks.
If Eddie's sense of direction failed them now, they wouldn't need it to kill them. They would wander until they died. Or, if they got into the wrong set of pipes, until they were drowned like rats in a rain barrel. But Eddie didn't seem a bit worried. Every now and then, he would ask Bill to light one of their diminishing store of matches, look around thoughtfully, and then set off again. He made rights and lefts seemingly at random. Sometimes the pipes were so big Bill could not reach their tops even by stretching his hand up all the way. Sometimes they had to crawl, and once, for 5 horrible minutes, which felt more like 5 hours, they wormed their way along on their bellies. Eddie now leading, the others following with their noses to the heels of the person ahead. The only thing Bill was completely sure of was that they had somehow gotten into a disused section of the dairy sewer system. They had left all the active pipes either far behind or far above. The roar of running water had dimmed to a far-off thunder. These pipes were older, not kiln-fired ceramic, but a crumbly, clay-like stuff that sometimes oozed springs of unpleasant-smelling fluid. The smells of human waste, those ripe, gassy smells that had threatened to suffocate them all, had faded. But they had been replaced by another smell, yellow and ancient, that was worse. Ben thought it was the smell of the mummy. To Eddie, it smelled like the leper. Richie thought it smelled like the world's oldest flannel jacket, now moldering and rotting. A lumberman's jacket. A very big one, big enough for a character like Paul Bunyan, perhaps. To Beverly, it smelled like her father's sock drawer. In Stan Uris, it woke a dreadful memory from his earliest childhood, an oddly Jewish memory in a boy who had only the haziest understanding of his own Jewishness. It smelled like clay mixed with oil and made him think of an eyeless, mouthless demon called the Golem, a clay man that renegade Jews were supposed to have raised in the Middle Ages to save them from the Goyim, who robbed them and raped their women and then sent them packing. Mike thought of the dry smell of feathers in a dead nest. When they finally reached the end of the narrow pipe, they slithered like eels down the curved surface of another, which ran at an oblique angle to the one they had been in, and found they could stand up again. Bill felt the heads of the matches left in the book. 4. His mouth tightened, and he resolved not to tell the others how close they were to the end of their light. Not unless he absolutely had to.
How you guys doing?
They murmured replies, and he nodded in the dark. No panic and no tears since Stan's. That was good. He felt for their hands, and they stood together in the dark that way for a while, both taking and giving from the touch. Bill felt clear exultation in this, a sure sense that they were somehow producing more than the sum of their 7 selves. They had been re-added into a more potent whole. He lit one of the remaining matches, and they saw a narrow tunnel stretching ahead on a downward slant. The top of this pipe was festooned with sagging cobwebs, some water-broken and hanging in shrouds. Looking at them gave Bill an atavistic chill. The floor here was dry, but thick with ancient mold and what might have been leaves, fungus, or some unimaginable droppings. Farther up, he saw a pile of bones and a drift of green rags. They might once have been that stuff they called polished cotton, workman's clothes. Bill imagined some sewer department or water department worker who had gotten lost, wandered down here, and been discovered. The match guttered. He tipped its head downward, wanting the light to last a little longer.
Do you know where we are? He asked Eddie.
Eddie pointed down the slightly crooked bore of the tunnel.
Canal's that way, he said. Less than 0.5 mile, unless this thing turns in a different direction. We're under Upmile Hill right now, I think. But Bill...
The match burned Bill's fingers, and he let it drop. They were in darkness again. Someone, Bill thought it was Beverly, sighed. But before the match had gone out, he had seen the worry on Eddie's face.
Well, what? What is it? When I say we're under Upmile Hill, I mean we're really under it. We've been going down for a long time now. Nobody'd ever put sewer pipe in this deep. When you put a tunnel this deep, you call it a mine shaft.
How deep do you figure we are, Eddie? Richie asked.
1/4 mile, Eddie said. Maybe more.
Jesus please us, Beverly said.
These aren't sewer pipes anyway, Stan said from behind them. You can tell by that smell. It's bad, but it's not a sewery smell.
I think I'd rather smell the sewer, Ben said. It smells like... A scream floated down to them. issuing from the mouth of the pipe they had just left, lifting the hair on the nape of Bill's neck. The seven of them drew together, clutching each other.
Gonna get you, sons of bitches. We're gonna get you.
Henry, Eddie breathed. Oh, my God, he's still coming.
I'm not surprised, Richie said. Some people are too stupid to quit. They could hear faint panting, the scrape of shoes, the whisper of cloth.
You!
Kaka, come on, Bill said. They started down the pipe, now walking double except for Mike, who was at the back of the line. Bill and Eddie, Richie and Bev, Ben and Stan.
How far back do you think Henry is?
I couldn't tell, Big Bill, Eddie said. The echoes are bad. He dropped his voice.
Did you see that pile of bones?
Yes, Bill said, dropping his own voice. There was a tool belt with the clothes. I think it was a water department guy.
I guess so.
How long you think?
I don't know.
Eddie closed his good hand over Bill's arm in the darkness. It was perhaps 15 minutes later when they heard something coming toward them in the dark. Richie stopped, frozen cold all the way through. Suddenly he was 3 years old again. He listened to that squelching, shifting movement, closing in on them, closing, and to the whispering branch-like sounds that accompanied it. And even before Bill struck a match, he knew what it would be.
The eye, he screamed. Christ, it's the crawling eye.
For a moment, the others were not sure what they were seeing. Beverly had an impression that her father had found her, even down here, and Eddie had a fleeting vision of Patrick Hochstetter come back to life. Somehow Patrick had flanked them and gotten in front of them. But Richie's cry, Richie's certainty, froze the shape for all of them. They saw what Richie saw. A gigantic eye filled the tunnel. The glassy black pupil, 2 feet across, the iris a muddy russet color. The white was bulgy, membranous, laced with red veins that pulsed steadily. It was a lidless, lashless, gelatinous horror that moved on a bed of raw-looking tentacles. These fumbled over the tunnel's crumbly surface and sank in like fingers, so that the impression given in the glow of Bill's guttering match was of an eye that had somehow grown nightmare fingers which were pulling it along. It stared at them with blank, feverish avarice. The match went out. In the darkness, Bill felt those branch-like tentacles caress his ankles, his shins, but he could not move. His body was frozen solid. He sensed it approaching. He could feel the heat radiating out from it, and he could hear the wet pulse of blood wetting its membranes. He imagined the stickiness he would feel when it touched him, and still he could not scream. Even when fresh tentacles slipped around his waist and hooked themselves into the loops of his jeans and began to drag him forward, he could not scream or struggle. A deadly sleepiness seemed to have suffused his whole body. Beverly felt one of the tentacles slip around the cup of her ear and suddenly draw a noose tight. Pain flared, and she was dragged forward, twisting and moaning, as if an old lady school teacher were giving her an out-of-patience come along to the back of the room, where she would be forced to sit on a stool and wear a dunce cap. Stan and Richie tried to back away, but a forest of unseen tentacles now wavered and whispered about them. Ben put an arm around Beverly and tried to tug her back. She clasped his hands with panicky tightness.
Ben, it's got me.
No, it don't. Wait, I'll pull.
He pulled with all his might, and Beverly screamed as pain tore through her ear and blood began to flow. A tentacle, dry and hard, scraped over Ben's shirt, paused, then twisted in a painful knot around his shoulder. Bill put out a hand, and it slapped into a gooey, yielding wetness.
The eye,
his mind screamed.
Oh, God, I got my hand in the eye. Oh, God, oh, dear, sweet God, the eye, my hand in the eye.
He began to fight now, but the tentacles drew him forward inexorably. His hand disappeared into that wet, avid heat. His forearm, now his arm, was plunged into the eye up to the elbow. At any moment, the rest of his body would come against that sticky surface, and he felt that he would go mad in that instant. He fought frantically, chopping at the tentacles with his other hand. Eddie stood like a boy in a dream, hearing the muffled screams and sounds of struggle as his friends were being pulled in. He sensed the tentacles around him, but none had as yet actually landed on him.
Run home,
his mind commanded him quite loudly.
Run home to your mama, Eddie. You can find the way.
Bill screamed in the dark, a high despairing sound that was followed by hideous squishings and slobberings. Eddie's paralysis broke wide open. It was trying to take Big Bill. No, Eddie bellowed. It was a full-blown roar. One might never have guessed such a Norse warrior sound could issue from such a thin chest, Eddie Casbrack's chest, Eddie Casbrack's lungs, which were, of course, afflicted with the most terrible case of asthma in Derry. He bolted forward, jumping over questing tentacles without seeing them, his broken arm thumping his own chest as it swung back and forth in its soggy cast. He fumbled in his pocket and brought out his aspirator.
Acid, that's what it tastes like. Acid, acid, battery acid.
He collided with Bill Denbrough's back and slammed him aside. There was a watery, ripping sound, followed by a low, eager mewling that Eddie did not so much hear with his ears as feel with his mind. He raised the aspirator.
Acid. It's acid if I want it to be. So eat it, eat it, eat.
Battery acid, fuck nuts. Eddie screamed and triggered off a blast. At the same time, he kicked at the eye. His foot went deep into the jelly of its cornea. There was a gush of hot fluid over his leg. He pulled his foot back, only dimly aware that he had lost his shoe.
Fuck off! Cram it, Sam! Go away, Jose! Get lost! Fuck off!
He felt tentacles touch him, but tentatively. He triggered the aspirator again, coating the eye, and felt heard that mewling again, now a hurt, surprised sound.
Fight it, Eddie raved at the others. It's just a fucking eye! Fight it, you hear me? Fight it, Bill. Kick the shit out of the sucker. Jesus Christ, you fucking pussies, I'm doing the mashed potatoes all over it, and I got a broken arm.
Bill felt his strength return. He ripped his dripping arm out of the eye and then slammed it fist first back in. A moment later, Ben was beside him. He ran into the eye, grunted with surprise and disgust, and then began to rain punches onto its jellied, quivering surface.
Let her go, he yelled. You hear me? Let her go. Get out of here. Get out of here.
Just an eye. Just a fucking eye.
Eddie was screaming deliriously. He triggered his aspirator again and felt it draw back. The tentacles which had settled on him now dropped away.
Richie, Richie, get it. It's just an eye.
Richie stumbled forward, unable to believe he was doing this, actually approaching the worst, most terrible monster in the world.
But he was.
He only threw a single weak punch, and the feel of his fist sinking into the eye, it was thick and wet and somehow gristly, made him throw his guts up in one big tasteless convulsion. A sound came out of him, glurt, and the thought that he'd actually puked on the eye caused him to do it again. It was only a single punch, but since he had created this particular monster, perhaps that was all that was necessary. Suddenly the tentacles were gone. They could hear it withdrawing. And then the only sounds were Eddie panting and Beverly crying softly, one hand to her bleeding ear. Bill struck one of their three remaining matches, and they stared at each other with dazed, shocked faces. Bill's left arm was running with a thick, cloudy goo that looked like a mixture of partially congealed egg white and snot. Blood was trickling slowly down the side of Beverly's neck, and there was a fresh cut on Ben's cheek. Richie slowly pushed his glasses up on his nose.
Are we all right?
Bill asked hoarsely.
Are you Bill? Richie asked.
Yeah.
He turned to Eddie and hugged the smaller boy with fierce intensity.
You saved my life, man.
It ate your shoe, Beverly said, and uttered a wild laugh.
Isn't that too bad?
I'll buy you a new pair of keds when we get out of here, Richie said. He clapped Eddie on the back in the dark.
How did you do it, Eddie?
Shot it with my aspirator. Pretended it was acid. That's how it tastes after a while if I'm having, you know, a bad day. Worked great.
I'm doing the mashed potatoes all over it, and I got a broken arm, Richie said and giggled madly.
Not too shabby, Eds.
Actually, pretty chuckalicious, tell you what.
I hate it when you call me Eds.
I know, Richie said, hugging him tightly.
But somebody has to toughen you up, Eds. When you stop leading the sheltered existence of a child and grow up, you're gonna, I say, you're gonna find out life ain't always this easy, boy.
Eddie began to shriek with laughter.
That's the shittiest voice I ever heard, Richie.
Well, keep that aspirator thing handy, Beverly said. We might need it again.
You didn't see it anywhere, Mike asked, when you lit the match?
It's gone,
Bill said, and then added grimly, "But we're getting close to it. To the place where it's just stays. And I think we hurt hit that time."
"Henry's still coming," Stan said. His voice was low and hoarse. "I can hear him back there."
"Then let's move out," Ben said. They did. The tunnel progressed steadily downward, and that smell, that low, wild stench, grew steadily stronger. At times they could hear Henry behind them, but now his cries seemed far away and not at all important. There was a feeling in all of them, similar to that feeling of skew and disconnection they had felt in the house on Niebolt Street, that they had progressed over the edge of the world and into some queer nothingness. Bill felt, although he did not have the vocabulary to express what he knew, that they were approaching Derry's dark and ruined heart. It seemed to Mike Hanlon that he could almost feel that heart's diseased, arrhythmic beat. Beverly felt a sense of evil power growing around her, seeming to enfold her, certainly trying to split her off from the others and make her alone. Nervously, she reached out on either side of herself and clasped Bill's hand and Ben's. It seemed to her that if she had to reach too far, and she called out nervously, "Hang on to hands, it's like we're moving away from each other." It was Stan who first realized he could see again. There was a low, strange radiance in the air. At first, he could only see hands, his clasping Ben's on one side and Mike's on the other. Then he realized he could see the buttons on Richie's muddy shirt and the Captain Midnight ring. Just some junky cereal box prize that Eddie liked to wear on his little finger.
"Can you guys see?" Stan asked, coming to a stop.
The others stopped, too. Bill looked around, first aware that he could see. A little, anyway, and that the tunnel had widened out amazingly. They were now in a curved chamber easily as big as the Sumner Tunnel in Boston. Bigger, he amended, as he looked around with a growing sense of awe. They craned their necks back to see the ceiling, which was now 50 feet or more above them, and held up by outcurving buttresses of stone-like ribs. Nets of dirty cobweb hung between them. The floor was now stone-flagged, but overlaid with such a drift of ancient dirt that the quality of their footfalls had never changed. The upcurving walls were easily 50 feet away on either side.
"Waterworks must have really gone crazy down here," Richie said and laughed uneasily.
"Looks like a cathedral," Beverly said softly.
"Where's the light coming from?" Ben wanted to know.
"Coming right out of the walls, looks like," Bill said.
"I don't like it," Stan said.
"Let's go. Henry will be breathing down our necks." A loud braying cry split the gloom, and then the ruffling, heavy thunder of wings. A shape came cruising out of the dark, one eye glaring. The other was a dark lamp.
"The bird!" Stan screamed. "Look out, it's the bird!"
It dived at them like an obscene fighter plane, its plated orange beak opening and closing to reveal the pink inner lining of its mouth, plush as a satin pillow in a coffin. It went straight for Eddie. Its beak raked his shoulder, and he felt pain sink into his flesh like acid. Blood flowed down his chest. He cried out as the backwash of its beating wings blew noxious tunnel air in his face. It wheeled back, its eye glaring malevolently, rolling in its socket, blurring only as its nictitating eyelid jittered down momentarily to cover the eye with tissue-thin film.